Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. The gravity of today's global environmental threats to life on Earth is no longer in question. For decades, our guest Paul Hawken has been at the forefront of the visionaries who have awakened us to the devastating consequences of our collective and individual actions. That's not changed, Mr. Hawken says in his book, Blessed Unrest. What has changed, he says, is there is now good news. It's just not being reported. People around the world are coming together in millions of organizations. They are people intent on changing humanity's ways before it's too late. Paul Hawken knows that achieving sustainability will require changes, big ones. To survive, he says, will take a fundamental transformation. Where do we begin? Mr. Hawken puts into play James Carse's powerful idea of finite and infinite games.
Finite games we're very familiar with are called Wall Street and politics and the NBA and any game where there's a definitive winner and loser. But infinite games are played differently because the rules of infinite games are that you do whatever it takes to keep the game going. So the rules actually change according to the conditions, but the goal is always constant, which is the game shall never end. And what I'm saying is that this whole word and this whole concept of sustainability is the infinite game. So really what you can see sustainability as a organized response to finiteness, to try to change the systems, whether it be economic or governmental, educational, religious or otherwise, into infinite games. So it's not to stop something so much as it is to change the nature of the process. I mean, basically, this is suicide intervention.
Paul Hawken is an environmentalist, entrepreneur, journalist, and author. His lifelong commitment to justice and his pioneering entrepreneurial ventures have inspired individuals and businesses everywhere. Mr. Hawken's books, Natural Capitalism, The Ecology of Commerce, and Growing a Business are international classics. In Blessed Unrest, he celebrates the unreported emergence of what he calls a worldwide movement without a name. It is communities and individuals successfully prevailing in the face of special privilege and wholesale environmental destruction. Bill Russell and I have tried repeatedly to bring you Paul Hawken, so it was a celebration for us when finally we could begin this conversation. Paul Hawken, I find that the birth metaphor means a lot to me, and I use it fairly often. So when I found you talking about the quickening of a movement, I thought, oh, we're doing biology here. We're doing ideas that are alive. We are doing things that are putting ideas to work. There's action in this. This birthing metaphor seems to be quite central to what you're talking about. Am I right?
You are right in more than one way. The book is about a movement that has no name. And therefore, because it's made of people, it is called a social movement that is made of people in society. When you look at the language of social movements that have preceded this, it is actually somewhat dry. And even if it wasn't dry, it doesn't adequately describe this movement, this unnamed movement. So I definitely had to reach for biological and metaphors in order to find the language that approximated what I was observing and what I experienced and what I wanted to write about.
You've been out in the big world for years doing this work, telling us what we need to know, both good news and bad news. And you've had a profound impact with other books. And this feels like a leap. This feels like something exponentially bigger that you're telling me about. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
People say that. I feel that it was always there, but I do feel that something shifted. I remember writing to W.S. Merwin, who's a friend, and I said, someday I want to be a real writer. And he wrote back this beautiful letter, and he said, the subject makes all the difference.
Indeed.
And I feel that with this subject, it really does make all the difference, because it's vast. It's historical, it's current, extraordinarily salient in terms of who we are today, who we will become and what will become of our children's children's children. And therefore, it had this richness with which to write within. And therefore, it opened up language, it opened up different writers' characters and historical figures from the past all began to be part of this pageant, this drama of today, right now, this moment, that is being played out across the world.
One of the things that jumped out at me is a notion that I guess I first came across with Robert Kuttner, which is the notion of economic fundamentalism, market fundamentalism. In this country, the United States, and at this time, in some ways, that seems to be the ascendant ideology. And in some ways, as you write about this, it seems to be, as much as anything, the challenge, the obstacle, the caricature, the bad guy, the black hat, in what we as a species are facing. And part of the attribute, of course, is it's fundamentalism, and any fundamentalism has some very negative attributes. This particular variation has the, from its standpoint, the benefit of generating wealth that allows it to behave in the ways that wealth allows one to behave. And as much as anything, it seems that the great challenge in what you're writing about and what you're talking about and what this movement, as you characterize it, is facing, is to deal with the brute force of this fundamentalist market fundamentalism and somehow generate counterforce to that.
Well, it's very well said, in that if there's a meta ideology in the world today, it is fundamentalism. And it is important, I think, to notice how many ways it's expressed. And we are more familiar with religious fundamentalism, regardless of the religion and the horrors that follow thereon. But I think it is less known, and we are less aware of economic fundamentalism or market fundamentalism or free market fundamentalism, whatever you want to call it. And all fundamentalisms share a common attribute, and that is that a few people think they understand what is best for a lot of people. And whether that's sincere or disingenuous is beside the point, because they take it upon themselves to make life better for the rest of us, despite what we say, do, or protest. And it's interesting to me that the World Bank is one of those expressions of free market fundamentalism. And I would say that we have encountered in our work at least 2,000 or 3,000 organizations who fundamentally correct the damage and the suffering that is caused by the IMF and the World Bank and the WTO.
Blessed unrest. Titles are important. Why is it blessed and why is it unrest? Why isn't it revolution?
Well, when the book started 14 years ago, and I was giving speeches, and I would meet people, and they would give me their cards, we'd exchange them. I would put them in various pockets and backpacks and come home and dump them on my kitchen table in the houseboat I was living in. Then I would look at the cards and read them in a way to honor them, to remember. Sometimes they had little notes on them. And then I'd put them away in a drawer. And that drawer was emptied into a big shopping bag in my closet by my housekeeper one day. And the bag continued to fill with cards until it was full. And when it was full, this book was born. And it was born of a simple question originally, which was, how many social justice and environmental organizations are there in the world? And it was no more than that, and no less than that. And as a person born and raised in a library, my father was a librarian, University of California, Berkeley, I just thought it'd be a simple task to find the answer. Everybody knows something in America, and I could not find out. I could look at tax records, which were notably incomplete and defunct in many cases. And there were smaller directories hither and thither. And I started to research the number. And as the number became higher, 30,000 and 70,000 and 100,000, 100,000, I said, wait a minute, let me check back in the records and find out, is there any social movement that is comparable with 100,000 different organizations? I found none. And it was during that time that I went to Seattle, 1999, to protest. I didn't go to write, I went to protest, just put my little bum down on the street. And when I left there, 4 days later, I went to Washington, D.C. to give a talk, and I got the Post and the New York Times and the L.A. Times to see what was written about Seattle. And I was appalled at the...
Let us say specifically what Seattle was.
Seattle was the when civil society belled the cat, or free market fundamentalism, basically.
That's it.
And said to the people meeting in the green rooms who were deciding trade policy for the world that there was some stakeholders missing.
And WTO didn't get to have it just its way forever.
It did not. That meeting failed, and there was a piece today in the New York Times saying that the whole system of globalization, IMF, World Bank, WTO, now is in crisis.
In 2007, it took that long to identify a crisis that was in the making?
That's lightning speed in our...
That is really, yeah, that is not glacial. That is overnight. And of course, the fact is that the crisis is being admitted. The crisis occurred a long time ago. But during that time, I wrote about Seattle, N30, November 30, the first day of the protests. And in doing the research about it, I discovered that the method of organization, how the protests were organized, really went back to the encuentras that were conducted in 1990 and 1992 in Quito, Ecuador, when the first peoples of North, Meso, and South America first got together and met since the conquest. And this scheme, if you will, of organization that was headless but very well integrated and coordinated began to, in a sense, made me realize that not only was there a lot of organizations, but there was something going on laterally here in terms of organizing. So the title of the book went through five iterations. And the first one was Uprising, and then 9/11 happened. I thought, no, no, no. So the second one was The Forgotten, The Excluded, and The Uninvited, which had the grace of poetry. There was Subcomandante Marcos' phrase, but it was a little doer. And the next phrase was The Other Superpower, which had a lot of bravura, but it didn't take long to realize that one is enough, we don't need another one. So
and that was playing off a very famous headline that there were now two superpowers in the world.
February 13th, 2003, in the New York Times.
And one was the United States and one was the people of the world.
Yeah. And then the next title was We Interrupt This Empire, which had humor going for it. But it wasn't until I was in Namibia 2.5 years ago and I read this quote by Martha Graham. And she was...
Martha Graham, a dancer.
A choreographer and dancer.
75 years ago.
Talking to Agnes DeMille. And Agnes DeMille had come into town. She had choreographed a show that had won an award or awards. It was fabulous. She had come back 6 months later, and the show had collapsed. And she was so dismayed, and it was her work. Her name was on the marquee. And she was complaining, and they went back to Martha's place, Brownstone, after the restaurant meal, and standing on the sidewalk, Martha Graham turned to Agnes DeMille and said, don't forget, we are artists. And as artists, we are never satisfied. There is this queer dissatisfaction, this blessed unrest that makes us march and makes us more alive than the other. And I just thought, here was a quote that had arms big and strong and wide enough to hold this unnamed movement without determining what it is, without defining it. Because even though I try to describe it in Blessed Unrest, I'm pretty careful not to delineate it and say what it is and isn't in some ways, because I feel that it's formative. Your analogy to quickening, it is not peaking. It is actually, I think, just starting in some ways. It has a long, long history, but in terms of its rate of growth, it's one of the fastest, probably the fastest growing movement in the world. And so I think we have to treat it tenderly in terms of naming it or thinking that we know what it is. And I felt blessed unrest described it without doing that.
There is a wonderful parallelism in this. I find increasingly that ecology covers a great deal of how the world works, and certainly at least how I see the world.
Rachel Carson would certainly agree with you.
Well, yes, and I mean, this book is full. It is if nothing else, and it is a great deal more, an example, a series of examples of ecologies, the existence of ecologies and the interaction of ecologies and the huge, I mean, you know, Gaia is one way of looking at it, but in some ways that's almost too simple-minded. Mm-hmm. It in some ways is richer than that. But the exciting thing about this is it is organic, it is Darwinian, it is not inevitable.
Mm-mm.
But it is, as you describe it, a remarkable thing, just as a phenomenon.
Without delineating it, what are the parameters? How would you explain what the it is?
Well, what I would say first is that we sort of look for love in all the wrong places, that I think as a civilization in crisis... Yes, we overwhelmingly we have a tendency to look for the next charismatic male vertebrate that's going to stand up somewhere, whether he is religious or she is political, and save us.
So that we don't have to do anything.
A person of such elegance and eloquence and integrity, a person of such vision and magnificence, you know.
Where is the leader?
That, you know, that finally, you know, the nightmare will be over and this person will show up, you know. And everything will change. And that vision is always shattered.
That's not how evolution works.
It doesn't work that way.
No, that is called a fairy tale for
a
reason.
And it's foisted upon us by other people all the time. And what I'm saying is that we call these organizations non-governmental organizations. Very interesting. But the real non-governmental organizations are in Washington, D.C. It's called the Senate and the Congress and the White House and the different cabinets. I mean, this is the area where we don't get governance. And this is not just true in the United States. And what we're seeing is people organize themselves to address the salient issues that government is failing at, which is poverty and climate and water and sanitation, economic polarization and the ravages of globalization, the death of the oceans, our soil. It's not just peak oil, it's peak soil. I mean, there's so many issues that are here that are being ignored, you know.
We're fostered,
and we're sort of whistling past the graveyard. And what you're seeing is a citizen movement arising, recreating and reimagining what true democratic process is to solve and address these problems in place, in situ, in location, in every culture, in every city, every country in the world. And that's why it is now the largest movement in the world. It consists of over 1 million organizations, not 100,000, and it may be as many as 2 million. We don't know. We know it's over 1 million.
We have the illusion, because we have news 24 hours a day from 17 different channels in 22 different languages, that we are well informed about what's going on in the world. You talk about this movement, and you point out that it is not understood. It is not reported. We don't know about it because nobody tells us about it.
Well, we don't understand it because we looked for organizations or movements that want to aggregate power. I said, we should pay attention. They're rebelling, they're fighting, they're marshaling their forces, they are organizing, they are protesting. However they do it, they want power. And we're accustomed to the idea that a social movement is addressing an imbalance of power. And therefore it wants to aggregate some to itself to regain some balance. And what we don't understand is that there's a movement arising that's trying to disperse the pathological concentrations of power. And we have no lexicon, we have no, you know, social vocabulary to understand that. So the tendency is to think, well, these people are powerless, you know, because they don't want power. And what they want is for us to be powerful, that is, the communities that they live in, the cultures from whence they came. And that is a very different agenda than concentrating power.
Paul Hawken is our guest. It is our honor as well as pleasure. He has written Blessed Unrest, How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming. However, we can talk about it, and we will do so when we return in just a moment. You talk, Paul Hawken, in Blessed Unrest, about living in a time of giants. Now, we do have the language to understand giants, and it isn't pretty.
No, it's not. I mean, big oil. ExxonMobil's profits last year, $40 billion were and are sufficient to provide clean and pure water for all billion people in the world who lack it right now.
And that's 1 year's profit.
1 year's profits, yeah. Walmart employs 1.8 million people. We burn, was it 20? I forget, 20
gajillion
million metric tons of coal every day, which spews into the atmosphere. 87 million barrels of oil. I mean, the data goes on and on.
Which leaves people saying, it's too big, I can't do anything about this, I'm hopeless.
Yes, it does.
But the age of giants, there are, in every culture, has the big impenetrable, and then this kid who puts his finger in the wall, or gets his slingshot out, or does something, just this little thing.
Or cuts down the beanstalk.
Well, in evolutionary terms, I mean, usually giantism is the end of the line. It's not the beginning. It's not power. It's the end of power. And I think we're seeing the sunset effect, really, of power in many manifestations. I believe that the neoconservative and other types of sort of quasi-populist movements are really the death throes of the ideological movements which were born in the 19th century and sort of duked it out in the 20th century at great damage to the world, 120 million people dying in wars. And what we're seeing is a movement that's arising that's not ideological. It's really about ideas.
And that's an important distinction.
It's very important because ideologies really constrain and dictate. And because if you're part of an ideological movement, you can't stray far. Before you're wrapped on the knuckles, you stray further than that and you're excommunicated if you're a liberation theologist in the Catholic Church. And so, but in the movement of ideas, ideas are welcomed. And ideas you try out. And if they work, you keep them. If they don't, you toss them. It's like evolution. But ideas open up and liberate because ideas breed ideas. Ideologies do not breed ideologies. Ideologies breed schisms and conflict and violence. And every ism in the world has ended up as a schism. And what's so marvelous about this movement, the very thing that people would connote as being powerless, that is to say, oh, there's a million organizations, they're atomized, most of them are grassroots, most of them are small, how can they possibly stand up to or have any effect on the power as it be? But what's so lovely about this movement is it can't be divided because it started that way. But what it can do is due to modern technologies, the cell phone, texting, internet, it can start to link up and hook up, connect, collaborate, and coalesce in ways. They're really unimaginable. And because it's under-resourced and underfunded, it's actually much more agile and effective and efficient at using these new technologies.
Well, and this is one of... I don't like using a war metaphor, but I think it is descriptive of the actual condition. Afghanistan and Iraq, neither country could the organized government stand up to American military power. Small groups of people committed to ideas are making life at best unpleasant and ultimately, in some form, both of the, you know, what we call insurgents, patriots perhaps from their perspective, very likely will win for precisely that reason, because you can't get them out in the open where you can beat them to death with your big weapons, which is the approach we tend to take. Having said that, I also want, I don't want to go away from this market fundamentalism and our ignorance, because I think that, as you say, I think you say, the United States is more or less the headquarters of market fundamentalism. The American media is dominant around the world, though less so than it used to be, blessedly. Part of the challenge, part of our ignorance, is in the degree to which we have, our media at least, has absorbed the perspective of market fundamentalism. So the only stories, not only they get reported, but the only stories we can see, that we have a language to describe are stories that are within the mythology of market fundamentalism. We simply have blinded ourselves to the reality of what you're describing.
Absolutely. The corporate concentration of media is definitely sort of like a civilizational death wish, because a democracy depends on two things. It certainly depends on participation in voting, but there is no valid and meaningful participation in voting unless there's a valid path of information to get to people. If people are cut off from information, then a democracy dies, and it doesn't matter if they go to the ballot box or not. And that is exactly where we are. But at the same time, and I want to emphasize this, I think this whole book, and I said this sort of in the appendix epilogue, after I'd written it, I realized that what we are witnessing is a enormous transition, a world that has been and is created by and for privilege, to a world created by community. And you're starting to see that very much so with respect to the media, because again, technologically now, the media has broken its boundaries. That is, it's broken out. It no longer can be contained by corporate giants because of the internet and podcasting and MP3 and cell phones, etc. So it's out. And as so often, we tend to minimize or laugh off the small players, you know. And I think we do, not we don't, I think in this room, but I think that the large, you know, giants do, and they do so at their peril, because there's such a crisis of legitimacy in the public media that is, I don't think people believe it. I think they want to watch their baseball games and their NASCAR races and their entertainment, American Idol, and that's all fine. But in terms of credibility as to information with respect to news and so forth, I think that was gone a long time ago.
People get their, a lot of young people, according to a recent survey, get their news from Jon Stewart, mm-hmm. from Stephen Colbert. The people we know in the news business deplore that, say it's dangerous, it's, you know, had all kinds of problems with that. The benefit of both of those programs is that they at least come with the kind of skepticism that came out of the Enlightenment. You know, where's the evidence? They are at least raising questions, and they're able to do it with humor. Unfortunately, we have an administration that's easy to parody, but they are able to do what you describe the mass media not being able to do, the popular media, which is to critically assess these fundamentalist-based stories that are being passed off as a description of what's going on in my world every day.
Well, not only critically assess, but the most powerful weapon in politics is laughter. I mean, if you want to delegitimize something faster, you laugh at it. And when people laugh at you, you're dead politically. And that's what they've done. And interestingly, in the surveys of the young people, my son is one of them who got his news from Jon Stewart, and he watched it religiously all through high school and still does, and college, is that when they do current events quizzes, they do better than if they're watching Jon Stewart than if they're watching NBC Nightly News. So they can make fun of it all they want, but the fact is that they're more literate and more current with respect to events. But I think more importantly than that, again, is that it's kind of like imperial. This is an imperial power saying, well, wait a minute, you know, you're questioning the emperor, and they are, and they do it with such panache, you know.
And the emperor is devoid of clothes.
Yeah, this does bring up that myth.
Yes, it does, good myth. I was quite taken aback how regularly you, in thinking about where we are, how we've gotten here, who we can be, went to the ideas that one of my favorite books of all time, Emerson, The Mind on Fire. The things that Emerson offered us in 1836 are so current and so powerful and so now that it was quite striking that you just couldn't go very far in Blessed Unrest, but what you're bumping up against Waldo.
Well, when I was researching it and I realized the scale, not that I know the exact scale, but that it was the largest movement in the world, albeit unnamed, then the question is, well, where did it come from? And the popular theory on the environmental side would say, well, post-Rachel Carson, which isn't true, although she deserves enormous credit for what she did and what she engendered. And on the social justice side, it goes back to the Code of Hammurabi in, you know, Babylon. So, I mean, you can't really open that bag up without really following it way back into history. But on the environment and social justice side, it really does lead to Emerson in this country. And I was surprised, actually, because I think when we are asked to read Emerson in high school, it's kind of a pain. And I think we don't really have the life experience to understand. We can read the language, but we can't understand the thoughts as well.
And as you say, in Calvinist America, they only give us a piece of it.
They really give us the stuff on prudence, but they don't give us the stuff that's elegiac and basically out there. And I read Mind on Fire. I read Richardson's work on Thoreau as well, and many other works about Emerson and that time. And I was quite stunned to note a particular occurrence that happened in Paris in 1833. After his wife had died in 1832, he went to take the tour, you know, the waters, I guess, whatever, to go to Europe and Coleridge and Wordsworth, and other of his colleagues were there to greet him. But he started in Malta, went up the Route of Italy, ended up in Paris in July in 1833, and went to the Jardin des Plantes, which is a botanical garden created by the Jussieu family, Bernard and Antoine Laurent. And it was a famous family of botanists and taxonomists and who created systematics. They were later employed by Wallace and Darwin. But in the cabinet, if you will, of natural history, they had displayed flora and fauna in these arrays of color and morphology and form that clearly one, in this case Emerson, could see the web of life. And of course he'd already been fascinated with nature in a kind of romantic way, but for the first time he could actually see the connection. And that night in his journal, it seems like the first time he's elated, that he has a joyous experience since his wife has died. And these are epiphanic entries into the journal about seeing the web of life. He doesn't use that term, but he sees how everything is connected, that it is all nature, and that our mind itself is nature. And therefore, what is the nature of the mind, and what is the nature of governance, and what is the nature of religion, of justice? And he has found his niche, he's found his vein, he's found this enormous wellspring of thinking and ideas that basically took him out of being the Unitarian minister, you know, in the Old South Church, and now he is a completely different person. And he comes back to America, and his first book is, of course, Nature, and the first person, one of the first people to buy it and read it is Harvard's first hippie, which is Henry David Thoreau.
And then, as they say, the rest becomes history.
Well, it's so interesting because the history gets even more complex, because after he addresses a senior class, Thoreau goes to Emerson's house in Cambridge, and, you know, he's been to Harvard for 4 years and studied the classics and basically is unemployable. And
this is so great.
Asks Emerson, what should I do? And Emerson says, keep a journal. And he does from that day on for 7,000 pages. It's such an incredible moment, you know, of advice.
Yes.
And it was really, you know, 12 years later when he was arrested by Sam Staples,
Thoreau,
walking in from Walden for not paying his poll tax, which he didn't pay because he was protesting the fact that Polk was elected knowing he would go to war with Mexico, and felt this was just an egregious violation of the Mexican people, of the American people, of the doctrine of war. When he was arrested, there's an apocryphal story of Emerson coming to jail and saying, Henry, what are you doing in there? And Thoreau saying, Waldo, what are you doing out there?
I don't care if it's apocryphal, it's still a great story.
Well, the reason it's a great story is because it actually delineates, if you will, the difference between the student and the teacher. And as we know, as students, we take our teachers at their word. And Thoreau took his teacher at his word, which is everything is connected. From Emerson's point of view, Thoreau had done something that stigmatized his reputation, therefore it was a scar, was something that was, you know, you didn't do in polite society. From Thoreau's point of view, as he said in his later essay, if the government is unjust, the just man is in jail. And therefore, if the Texas Rangers are raping Mexican women, then if I pay my tax for it, I am a rapist. And that is so interesting to me, not just because of the relationship, because here now Thoreau, who is a great scientist and naturalist, really superb, if he'd only done that, he would be in the academy. But here in his essay, then called Resistance to Civil Government, he creates a whole branch of social justice.
And it is now called?
Civil disobedience.
And of course, that then rolls like the thunder across the ages.
It does.
And don't you find that in this million or 2 million or 3 million organizations, don't you see little sparks off of that log?
I don't think there's anywhere where the meme of civil disobedience doesn't exist and hasn't permeated this movement.
That's a big change.
One of the challenges is our deep denial of reality.
Well, there's that.
And I say that in the context talking about the Mexican War. In our history, you know, in the history I grew up with, it was a blip. It was, you know, remember the Alamo, kill a lot of Mexicans, live happily ever after.
Oh, and do take Texas with it.
Well, Texas and Arizona.
And California. And
New Mexico and Arizona and Colorado.
So that you can have California.
Which is, you know, the great chauvinist perspective. We are still paying the price for this. Mm. Today, we are arguing, you know, we're one another's throats. Americans are one another's throat about immigration, which focuses principally on the Mexican border.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not as if Thoreau was just being obdurate or a radical. These things have real-world consequences, and they're real-world consequences that endure. They don't just go away. So that these behaviors, these national behaviors and these individual behaviors, are critical to who and what we are as a species.
And everything matters.
Mm.
Isn't that part of what this book is about, that everything everybody does matters?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the takeaways of that story about Emerson and Thoreau, because it keeps going, is that we tend to focus, in hindsight, on events in history that we then determine are the turning points. And then, in so doing, we look ahead and look for the turning point, the charismatic leader, philosopher, religious person. But in fact, when we really parse history very carefully, what we find is that many, many, many seemingly tiny, inconsequential acts change history.
This is back to biology.
Absolutely.
This is one tiny piece of DNA changes the whole organism.
Well, look at civil disobedience itself. Thoreau never used the term. It's not in any of his writings. It's not in any of the writings he read at that time. No one knows who named the essay Civil Disobedience because it was named 4 years after he died. And it is such a powerful meme, that phrase itself, and it had such huge importance for a young solicitor in South Africa named Mohandas K. Gandhi, because he had presided over a meeting of Muslims and Hindus who were outraged at the Asiatic Registration Act that had been passed, the Black Act, that required apartheid, that required them to carry around these cards and show them it passes.
And this is Indians from some kind of India in South Africa.
1906. And he presided over a meeting which 1,100 of his countrymen voted to get arrested rather than register. And as a solicitor, he wrote in his journal that night how concerned he was about what they had agreed to and what were the implications, which he realized he hadn't thought through. And it was shortly thereafter when somebody who we don't know gave him a copy of Civil Disobedience, and somebody from the Indian Times gave it to him. And it was a revelation, because what Thoreau did was make going to jail cool. that it was not a stigma, it was a badge of honor.
And Paul Hawken tells this along with many important stories in Blessed Unrest. Come back for more stories when we return in a moment. What a pleasure to be with Paul Hawken, author of many things, including Blessed Unrest. I, Paula Gordon, Bill Russell, of course. Your book, put into the hands of the industrialist Ray Anderson, had that same kind of effect. This is back to everything matters. Mm. And the power of the purse, everything we buy is a vote. These are very empowering, hopeful stories in a time when it is my contention America has been pushed into depression, serious clinical depression, where people are both hopeless and helpless. Hearing these stories, as happened with David Suzuki when he made a great transformation, said, oh, you know, they're not listening to me. Being Jeremiah, I think I'm going to bring them some good news for a change, as he called that book. Isn't that some of why you spend all these days on the road and Jane Goodall, 300 days a year, and the people who are doing things to remind us that this one act can change history?
Exactly.
And you can never know what it's going to be.
You cannot. You cannot. And in going back to Ray, I mean, I wrote a College of Commerce. I don't know how many people have read it. Several hundred thousand copies have been sold. But I realize now that if only one person had read that book, Ray Anderson, it was worth every second and minute of the 2 years it took to research and write it. And so we cannot understand the cumulative effect of our activities. And what is even more important is that we have no control over the outcome. We have no control over the future, whether it's a minute or a year or a decade or a century from now. And I think one of the things you see in the nonprofit movement is the unnecessary taking on of the burden of the future and sinking into despair or sinking into hopelessness or sinking into a sense of ineffectiveness because things are getting worse. And I would just counsel anyone who feels that to just throw that little monkey away, because it is simply unnecessary, because the only thing we can control is our intention. And from a Buddhist perspective, we have a million intentions a second. And but from a practical point of view, the fact is, it is the one thing that we can hold true, and nobody can take that away from us. And it was the intention of so many different people that created activities that we then see rising up and become sort of epiphenomenal and historic and important. But underneath these are very, very wonderful, ordinary people like Joanne Robinson, who basically created the Montgomery Improvement Association, which created the context for Rosa Parks and created the organization that elected Martin Luther King to head the boycott. So we don't hear about Joanne Robinson. There's a true leader, you know, who was ahead of the game and really was somebody who never did anything for herself or to get acclaim or to be noticed, but actually did the work.
It was the church ladies.
Yes, the church ladies. But this is true everywhere in the world. And again, why it's not seen as powerful, because we think somebody should rise up and be, you know...
But that's being lazy.
Charismatic and megalomaniac or...
Well, it's also, I mean, this the important one of the many important things is these stories. We experience the world through the stories we tell each other. Mm-hmm. And if we don't hear these stories, mm-hmm. then we don't... I mean, as much as anything, the stories you tell and lots of other people have told are stories that tell us about possibilities, about different ways of acting, and more fundamentally, about different ways of thinking, about different ways of seeing the world around us, and then the possibility of what we can do with that. And if we don't have those, we get ourselves collapsed into this, whatever the fundamentalist ideology is that year, we end up being a party to that.
Well, I think the helplessness and the hopelessness, the depression, oppression, suppression of self that you feel in this country is because the narratives are moribund. And if there's nothing worse than an old story, it's an old story that is repeated and that
over
just
and
simply
over.
Has no meaning. And I do feel that there are new stories, and this is a time of change with respect to our narratives, and they are being heard, but they're being heard from the bottom up.
Which, of course, is where things happen. You talk about those 12 people, nice biblical number, but the 12 people in a pub in London who sit down and say, you know, slavery is the basis of everything we know in our entire world and our total structure, and it ain't right.
Yeah, and again, you go past the transcendentalists, you go to 1787, the Clarkson and Wilberforce and 12 people who got together and did something which is so remarkable, which is at a time when 3 out of 4 people were either enslaved or indentured, virtual slavery in the world, they challenged the whole concept of it, the trafficking of it, the commerce of it, and they were denounced, absolutely denounced as being progressive, liberals, do-gooders, that they were meddlers, they didn't know what they
were
doing.
And they would destroy the economy, a familiar description.
Exactly, that they destroyed the British economy. In other words, they were meddling in areas that they did not fully understand the implications of.
And they were challenging the heart of the status quo.
Absolutely. And what's so interesting about that is that if you really look back at that moment, so what makes that so distinctive? Of course, abolition itself was very, you know, important. But beyond that, it was the first time that human beings had gotten together in history to organize themselves, to work on behalf of others whom they would never know and from whom they would never receive direct or indirect benefit. And now we have so many organizations and people who do that. No one thinks twice about it, and yet someone did it first.
David Orr talks about the environmental conditions that we are creating, and in our every moment, as you say, one day of my life, I have the effect of a year of my ancestors, 1 year of my life, 100,000 years of my ancestors. And he talks about the long-term effects being those of slavery. So
yes,
the slavery motif is not an irrelevant one.
Not at all. And when we think of climate change and think of climate justice and we think of that climate change is another type of colonialism, it's another type of imperialism. It's the activity of a small group of people forcing everyone else basically to change and in many ways lose things which are part of their commons and part of their culture.
There is a perspective that the disaster in Darfur is directly connected to climate change, that the pastoralists and the farmers are at one another's throat because there's not enough water, and there's not enough water because of the changes in the atmosphere. So that, you know, to say these kinds of things don't have practical political life consequences is mistaken. You tell a story that to me is... It's a story, but it's emblematic of both the challenge and the opportunity, and it's the story of a group of people who work for a chemical company who, for one reason or another, end up being broken up into groups to go out and do a project in 2 hours. If you will tell that story, it is just to me a paradigmatic representation of what you're talking about.
Starting with that vice president who said, oh, no, that's socialist and communist, yeah, and you can't do that.
Well, we were giving sort of Ecology 101 or Environment 101 lecture to executives at a chemical company, and their biggest product was pesticides. That was their cash cow. And in the process of doing that, we just simply talked about the fact that a sustainable world had equitable distribution of resources, to which there was a great clamor and protest about it being socialistic and communistic, that had nothing to do with the environment, and to keep that kind of dialogue out, because this was, you know, capitalist America.
This is business.
We're serious businessmen here.
We're businessmen here. We don't play around with, you know, distribution and inequality. So precisely because of that reason, we created an exercise where they... were divided up. These are mostly engineers or engineering background, so they love to build, tinker, imagine. And we divided them into 4 groups, and their job was to design a spaceship that would leave here and come back in 100 years with everybody alive and well.
And happy.
and happy. And it could be pretty much as big as they wanted for, to a certain. So size wasn't a constraint. Propulsion wasn't a constraint. Light can enter in. So it could receive light, but nothing could go out. In other words, there was no place you could dump things into space. And they were to design it, everything, the culture, the people, the agriculture, the water systems, the waste systems, and report back.
This is their survival system.
Absolutely. And present it to their cohorts and their colleagues, their different designs, and then they'd all vote on which one they wanted to go on, which they thought would be the most likely to survive. And one ship won overwhelmingly, hands down. And what was so interesting about it was that, first of all, they took lots of insects and weeds onto the spaceship. In other words, they took all the things that they killed for profit, and they needed them on the spaceship in order to create a sustainable method of agriculture. Next, they took none of the other products they made because they were too toxic to keep in a closed environment. And next is that instead of taking DVDs and CDs and videos and, you know, sort of archival records of movies and, you know, culture, they decided to bring a lot of artists and singers and dancers and storytellers on board. And they realized that over a period of time, if they didn't create a culture, they would be at each other's throat, that they couldn't just import a culture and watch it. They actually had to create something and have people who were creative. So there's a lot of artists on this spaceship. And in the process of presenting it, I then asked the same person who had objected to equal distribution or equity in the world, if it was okay that 80% of what was produced on this spaceship was consumed and owned by 20% of the population on the spaceship. And he just went nuts, and he said, no, that's ridiculous, it would never work, and he went carrying on the same way he objected the first time, only now it was the opposite. And in that moment, of course, he stopped and he realized what the contradiction was that he carried. And it was so beautiful because, I mean, it was Buckminster Fuller who said that this spaceship we're on is so ingeniously designed, we don't know we're on one. And they realized, I think, in that moment that they were on one, and that it was scale that had really fogged the lenses of their glasses and prevented them from seeing the relationship.
Listening to you tell that story, I'm sitting here thinking, this sounds like a vision of life as play and possibility, a.k.a. a finite and an infinite game, the latter being descriptive of that condition. And that is how James Kars describes culture, as an open system. But you reference him, and I think you do it zestfully and because it's highly relevant.
Well, James was saying basically there are finite and infinite games, and finite games we're very familiar with are called Wall Street and politics and the NBA and any game where there's a definitive winner and loser. But infinite games are played differently because the rules of infinite games are that you do whatever it takes to keep the game going. So the rules actually change according to the conditions, but the goal is always constant, which is the game shall never end. And what I'm saying is that this whole word and this whole concept of sustainability is really the infinite game. So when these organizations see that a river is polluted, they're worried about the fish game because the fish game will end. So they address the fish game. And if it's to children, then it's the children game. When we bombed all the sewage treatment plants in Iraq in the first Gulf War and basically spread disease and cholera all over the place. When it's the clear-cutting of ancient forests in British Columbia, then it's the forest grizzly bear habitat game. In other words, really what you can see sustainability as a organized response to finiteness. In other words, to try to change the systems, whether it be economic or governmental, educational, religious, or otherwise, into infinite games. So it's not to stop something so much as it is to change the nature of the process.
And in one of his characterizations of an infinite game is that you play, in a finite game, you play within the rules, in an infinite game, you play with the rules.
Yes.
It's also worth saying that a finite game, by definition, has an end.
Yes.
And that is what we are trying to avoid. We're talking about crisis, but what we're really talking about is species suicide. And I think most of us would like to not make this a finite game.
And yeah. Basically, my friend Kenny Acevedo said, this is suicide intervention.
Yes, yes. And one last piece that I want to explore just for a moment. You say throughout history as we know it, always there have been more rights given to the business oligarchy people, a small number, a minority, and that it is time to be looking at where should rights be granted and given.
Absolutely. And I think we're seeing really in response to the crises and to peak oil and the other peaks, peak water, peak soil, peak everything, peak fish, that communities are starting to recoalesce. They're starting to realize that in order to be resilient, to be durable, to be strong, to be meaningful, and to be able to absorb the shocks that may be coming in the future, they need to reorganize. And we have to stop importing our lives in terms of food and water and culture and recognize that what we've always known, that is our lives are really homegrown, that all meaningful culture is homegrown, and that we can create a world without inequality and wealth without plunder and a future without fear. That those are within our grasp, but they're in our grasp in place, and that if we do that in place, that can grow. But this is a bottom-up movement because the top-down world is corrupt and been corrupted badly. And so our friends and our solutions lie right close to us, you know, on all sides of us and around us, in our neighbors, in our communities. And so this movement not only is addressing the sort of the mega problems and the mega institutions, but at the same time it's really recreating life from the bottom up. And life always organizes from the bottom up, and it always organizes with information.
And that makes it very hopeful.
Yes.
Thank you for being hopeful and practical, all within a blessed unrest. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Paul and Bill, thank you very much.
Paul Hawkins' Blessed Unrest is full of the kinds of stories we need as we come together to save life on Earth. We are profoundly grateful to him for all the ways Paul Hawkins has worked for justice over the decades. And we look forward to learning how you are putting Paul Hawkins' vital ideas to work. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.